The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. The next half hour, I'm going to be reading articles from the Harvard Health Letter and probably from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter as well. And the first article comes from the August 2022 Harvard Health Letter, and it's entitled Tips to Choose the Best Lens for Cataract Surgery. It's a big investment, and you'll want to make it only once. Here are the options and common considerations. Every year, millions of people have routine surgery to replace a cataract. That is, a lens in the eye that has become clouded. Cataracts cause foggy or blurred vision that make it hard to do everything from reading to driving. Replacing the lens restores clear vision. It can also correct other vision problems and reduce your dependence on glasses. Think of it as customizing the lens to focus powers that will suit you best, says Dr. Nandini Venkatsawaran, a surgeon who specializes in cataract surgery and corneal disease at Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts Eye and Ear. Swapping lenses. Cataract surgery takes place in an outpatient surgery center. You're given medicine to relax you and keep your eye numb. Your surgeon then makes a small incision in the eye, inserts tiny instruments, and breaks up and removes the cataract. The surgeon may use ultrasound or laser technology to carry out these steps. With the cloudy lens gone, the surgeon can place an artificial lens in the same space to give you clear vision. Recovery can take 4 weeks. You'll have to use special eye drops during that time, and you'll need to avoid heavy lifting for at least a week. There are many choices for lenses to replace a cataract. The first is monofocal lenses. These lenses give you the ability to see clearly at one distance point, which could be up close, at arm's length, or far away. You'll need glasses for the distances you don't choose. Let's say the person golfs and wants to see everything in the distance. We can set the lens for faraway vision. If the person's an avid reader and wants to look at material up close, we can focus the lens for close vision. We can also set the lens for intermediate vision, like looking at a car dashboard or a computer. If you need to have cataracts replaced in both eyes, you may choose to have a close-up focal point for one eye and a far-away focal point for the other. That combination, known as monovision, relies on the brain to adjust to the two distances so you can see both near and far. Wider range lenses. Some lenses help you see clearly at more than one distance. Multifocal lenses use two focal points. Trifocal lenses have three. Extended depth of focus lens provides excellent intermediate and distance vision and some up close vision. Trifocal lenses have the most vision range, but they come with the risk of glare and halos at night. Extended depth of focus lenses work differently and have a lower risk of halos, but you may still need reading glasses, especially in dim light. Two other types of lenses are toric lenses and light adjustable lenses. Toric lenses correct astigmatism, blurred vision from an abnormally curved cornea. Toric lenses are available in monofocal, trifocal, or extended depth of focus versions. The light adjustable lens contains photosensitive material that can be altered using external ultraviolet light and therefore allows adjustment of the focusing distance soon after surgery. Here are some tips to help you choose a replacement lens. Standard monofocal lenses and the surgery to implant them are covered by Medicare. You'll still have to pay deductibles. For all other lenses, you may pay out of pocket for the lens and surgery fee. Insurance usually covers the cost of the operating room and anesthesia. Lenses and fees are not cheap, and they're usually offered as a package deal. You can expect to pay $1,500 to $2,500 per eye for a toric lens, $3,000 to $4,000 per eye for a wide-range lens, and $5,000 to $6,000 per eye for the light adjustable lens. Tell your surgeon about your daily vision needs. Do you like wearing glasses? Can you tolerate halos and glares at night? Do you read a lot? Do you do a lot of driving? Answering these questions can help you narrow your list of options. Consider your existing vision problems. You need a certain amount of astigmatism to be a candidate for toric lenses, Dr. Venkatesa Warren says. If you have eye disease like glaucoma or retinopathy, you may not be a candidate for certain premium lenses. Getting a replacement lens is a big commitment, so learn as much as you can before making your selection. Your doctor will help you. It's a lot like matchmaking. We want to find the right lens for you, and we don't want to change it later on. The next article from the Harvard Health Letter of August 2022 is entitled, What's That Shoulder Sound? Crunching, clicking, grinding, or popping from the shoulder can be alarming. It catches you off guard, a sudden crunch, pop, or click from your shoulder you've never heard before. Is your shoulder sounding an alarm? Is it normal aging? The answer depends on a number of factors. The shoulder is made up of three bones, the upper arm bone, the collarbone, and the shoulder blade, and many soft tissues, muscles, ligaments, and tendons. Within the shoulder are four joints. The main joint is a ball and socket. The top of the upper arm is the ball that fits into a shallow socket in the shoulder blade. Aging, bone growths, and injuries can cause changes to the shoulder that generate sounds from time to time. Sounds fishy. There's no one sound unique to a particular shoulder problem. That makes it hard to know what various shoulder noises are telling you. Here are some possibilities. The first is arthritis. When cartilage that cushions the shoulder joints wear away, the bones rub against each other. Or sometimes the cartilage frays as it wears out, like pilling on a sweater. As the ball glides against it, it makes noise, says Dr. Jason Simon, an orthopedic surgeon with Harvard-affiliated Newton Wellesley Hospital. Arthritis can be accompanied by stiffness and pain. The next is bone breaks. Broken bones can rub up against each other audibly. Breaks are accompanied by pain, swelling, discoloration, and stiffness. Rotator cuff tears. The rotator cuff is made up of tendons that help you to raise and rotate your arm. The tendons also help to keep the ball centered in the socket. If you have a tear in a tendon, the ball can move abnormally, or there could be loose tissue that gets caught as you move your arm. Both will make noise. Tears are accompanied by pain that gets worse with shoulder use. The next is gas bubbles. When you move your shoulder, it can release gas that is built up in a bubble in the joint. It doesn't hurt. The release is similar to cracking your knuckles. Then there are bone spurs. Sometimes calcified growths develop in the shoulder. The most common bone spur can rub up against the rotator cuff. This can result in noises or pain, particularly with overhead motion. Then there are neck problems. In some cases, what you perceive as a shoulder sound may actually come from your neck. For example, it may come from neck bones that rub together due to worn cartilage. Then there is bursitis. The shoulder joint contains a number of small fluid-filled sacs called bursae that protect tendons from the bones and ligaments that they glide over. When a bursa is swollen or inflamed, it gets compressed as the joint moved, which creates a sound, Dr. Simon explains. Then there are loose parts. You might not feel tiny pieces of debris in your shoulder, like bits of cartilage that have broken off or detached stitches from past shoulder surgeries, but they can make noise as they move within the joint. What you should do. Dr. Simon recommends investigating shoulder noises if you have shoulder pain, weakness, or limited movement, or if the sound follows a shoulder injury. He says it's also smart, but not urgent, to ask your doctor about shoulder sounds that aren't accompanied by their symptoms. It's always better to be safe and catch something before it gets worse. Seek help from your primary care doctor, who may refer you to an orthopedic surgeon. To make a diagnosis, the doctor will conduct a physical exam and order imaging tests like X-rays or MRI scans. Treatment, if necessary, doesn't automatically mean surgery. Some conditions need only physical therapy or anti-inflammatory medications or injections. If there is something torn, broken, or completely worn out, we may consider surgery, but that's a last resort, says Dr. Simon. Shoulder noise doesn't mean there's an operation in your future. The next article in the Harvard Health Letter of August 2022 is entitled Brushing Off Heart Failure Symptoms. Overlooked symptoms and disparities in healthcare can delay diagnosis and treatment. Heart failure is a chronic, progressive, life-threatening condition in which the heart does not pump well. Despite its serious nature, initial symptoms may not seem concerning. Heart failure is often missed because it can be subtle. It's not usually diagnosed until months or years later when the symptoms become intolerable. By that point, the risk for dying from it has also risen significantly, sometimes higher than the risk of death from cancer. So it's important to catch heart failure early, says Dr. James Januzzi, the Hutter Family Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School and a cardiologist at Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts General Hospital. There's two main ways the heart failure symptoms affect the body and trigger further symptoms. One is reduced blood flow to tissues and organs. When they don't receive enough oxygen to do their job, any demand you place on your heart, like climbing stairs or walking to the kitchen, can make you feel tired. The other is the body's attempts to make up for low blood flow. The body retains salt in fluid to expand blood volume. Because the heart isn't pumping well, the fluid winds up accumulating in the legs and other areas, causing a buildup called congestion. Congestion in the lungs can cause shortness of breath, coughing, or wheezing. In the liver or intestines, congestions can lead to nausea, fullness soon after eating, weight gain, abdominal bloating, or abdominal pain, Dr. Januzzi said. When heart failure symptoms are subtle, they can be overlooked and attributed to other causes. For example, shortness of breath may be blamed on being out of shape. Fatigue may be chalked up to getting older. Swollen ankles can be attributed to a sedentary lifestyle. The overlap between heart failure and signs of less sinister health issues can make people feel as if nothing is wrong, particularly early on. Even doctors can miss the warning signs. Dr. Januzzi says, For example, I've seen patients with heart failure who were first referred for gallbladder disease because they developed abdominal pain when they ate. These people can suffer for months to years without proper diagnosis. Other obstacles to diagnosis. Undiagnosed heart failure isn't just a matter of hard-to-detect symptoms. Other obstacles to diagnosis include gender, ethnic, and racial disparities. Heart failure is frequently underdiagnosed in women, Black, and Hispanic individuals. In part, that's due to limited access to health care. But sexism and racism in the system may also lead to certain groups receiving less attention when it comes to recognizing heart failure symptoms, Dr. Januzzi says. Because heart failure is often undetected, Dr. Januzzi suggests calling your doctor to report even subtle signs of the disease. This is especially true if symptoms are new and if you have risk factors like diabetes, other heart disease, high blood pressure, obesity, or an unhealthy lifestyle like smoking, a poor diet, inactivity, or excess alcohol intake. To diagnose heart failure, a doctor typically conducts a physical exam and orders an electrocardiogram. You may have a blood test to look for natriuretic peptides, substances released by the heart at the earliest stages of heart failure. Dr. Januzzi helped to develop the tests to detect these substances. You may also have an echocardiogram, an ultrasound of the heart to determine its size, its structure, and its ability to pump. If you're diagnosed with heart failure, you'll need treatment as soon as possible. There's unmistakable evidence that earlier treatment is associated with better outcome, Dr. Januzzi says. Treatments include medications, low-salt diet, reduced fluid intake, and increased exercise. The good news is there are now many types of medications that lower the risk of heart failure complications, reducing the need for hospitalization or the progression of the disease to premature death, Dr. Januzzi says. We're not only helping people live much longer, but also dramatically improving their symptoms so they can have a better quality of life with more energy. Finally, in the Harvard Health Letter of August 2022, there is an article entitled, "Little Things That Can Improve Your Health." Eating a plant-based diet, exercising, controlling weight, not smoking, limiting alcohol intake, and getting enough sleep are all pillars of a healthy lifestyle. They're linked to lower risks of chronic disease and longer life. Many other activities contribute to good health, too. Some seem so minor that it's easy to forget about them, especially when you're focused on the big goals of exercising and eating nutritious meals. Use this guide to help you fit more little things into your day. Set a timer and take a break every 30 minutes to do the following activities. Get up and move. Too much sitting is associated with increased risk for obesity, diabetes, cancer, heart disease, and early death. On the flip side, moving, even just a little, is linked with reduced risk for chronic disease. An activity break doesn't have to be fancy. Just standing up helps to improve how your body uses blood sugar, says Imin Lee, a senior exercise researcher and professor of medicine at the Harvard Medical School. Imin Lee suggests giving this routine a try every 30 minutes. Stand up, reach your arms to the sky, stretch, twist your trunk to the left and right. Then walk around to get your heart and lungs working a little harder. You might do a quick household chore. Unload a dishwasher. Fold a load of laundry. You might climb up and down the stairs, or get the mail, or dance to a favorite song. Make sure you move your arms and legs. That's good for your muscles, which get tight when you sit too long. And it's good for your posture, too, which tends to be hunched on a couch and slouched at a desk, Lee says. The next suggestion is every half an hour, drink a little water. Staying hydrated keeps every cell in your body functioning well, and it takes a concerted effort to make sure you're getting enough fluids, which can come from water, juice, or watery foods like berries or soup. To find out how much fluid your body needs, divide your body weight in pounds by 3. For instance, a 144-pound person would need 48 ounces of fluid per day, or about 6 cups. If you don't want to guzzle a cup of water here or there, just drink an ounce or two every half an hour. You'll ensure that you've met your hydration needs by the end of the day. Then, every few hours, it's important to practice some habits every few hours. Schedule them at times when it makes the most sense for your day, like a break in between two tasks. For example, have a snack. Smaller, more frequent meals can help you to keep up your energy, keep your blood sugar levels stable, and increase the variety of foods in your diet, says Liz Moore, a registered dietitian at Harvard-affiliated Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. She recommends having a small snack between a light breakfast and a lunch, and then another between a light lunch and a dinner. The snack needs to be nutritious. Combine protein and carbohydrates. What makes a great snack? Moore recommends half a cup of non-fat Greek yogurt with berries, a handful of nuts, an apple or banana with a spoonful of peanut butter, half a cup of whole grain cereal with milk, a hard-boiled egg with whole grain crackers, or even just a small portion of leftovers from your last meal. Be mindful. Being mindful is being present in the moment and taking in the sights, sounds, smells, and feelings you experience. Practice mindfulness by simply stopping what you're doing and focusing on what your senses pick up. While washing your hands, for example, notice the temperature of the water, how your hands glide over each other, or what the soap smells like, how the process makes you feel. Or go on a brief, mindful walk outside. Observe the shape and colors of leaves on the trees, the smell in the air, the sound of birds, and how it all makes you feel. The process of being mindful is associated with reduced stress and anxiety, improvement in sleep, mood, focus, and concentration, and better management of pain and chronic disease. Use eye drops. It only takes the blink of an eye to keep your eyes moist. Blinking stimulates the production of tears and oils. Aging slows tears production, and when you add a lot of electronic screen time, like watching TV or looking at a smartphone or a computer, which makes you stare more and blink less, you can get dry eyes. The fix is using artificial tears periodically. The drops don't have to be preservative-free unless you use them more than 6 times per day. Finally, there are some little things that you can do once a day. Learn something new. Learning strengthens existing brain cell connections and makes new ones, which helps to keep thinking and memory sharp. The more synapses you build, the better shape you'll be in later. As you start to lose synapses naturally with age, schedule a time every day to learn something new, whether you watch part of a documentary, listen to a new type of music, read a nonfiction book, or watch an interesting lecture on YouTube. Write down what you learn and share the information with someone in your life. Also, chat with someone outside your household. Social connection thoroughly engages the brain. And when you have an enjoyable or meaningful interaction with someone, it increases brain cell connections, boosts mood, reduces isolation and loneliness, and may play a role in reducing the risk for chronic disease and premature death. Try to schedule some sort of social connection at least once per day. It may just be a phone visit with a friend or a chat with a neighbor. And if it's someone you don't see every day, that's even better, Dr. Budson says, because it will facilitate new connections in your brain rather than simply strengthening existing ones. Finally, meditate. Meditating activates the relaxation response, the antidote to the body's stress response. In the short term, stress temporarily triggers a cascade of physiologic changes that prepare us for fight or flight. If we're always stressed, those effects can lead to chronic inflammation, high blood sugar, high blood pressure, and more. Eliciting the relaxation response at least once a day by meditating, for example, helps to reduce stress and makes you better at coping with it. There are lots of ways to meditate, like doing 10 or 15 minutes of deep breathing, yoga, mindfulness, or transcendental meditation. And there's an illustration next to this that says, talking to someone outside your household at least once a day is important for overall health. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's NC. readingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Thank you.